thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is A.J. Jacobs, award-winning author of the new book, The Year of Living Constitutionally. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This is the very first Two Jewish episode of June, so it's probably time to start talking about summer plans, which for families with school-age kids means sending your loved little ones and medium-sized ones off to Jewish summer camp. Lest you think this is simply an expensive effort by mom and dad, or mom, or dad, or two moms, or two dads, or some combination of stepmoms and stepdads, or whatever the contemporary parenting situation is, to get their little tykes or teens out of the way for a month or two, please understand that Jewish summer camp is considered an important immersive Jewish experience for youngsters. It's the opportunity to live a fully realized Jewish life in a carefully curated environment in which a more complete way of living Jewishly can be explored in an embracing community of young people. Depending on the religious orientation of the camp, usually that means saying Hamotzi or other prayers before meals, singing the Birkat Hamazon, the grace, after every meal, having Jewish song sessions, holding religious services at least daily, and learning Jewish values and ways to express them in art, poetry, and actions. Often the good Jewish camps, and aren't they all good, give campers the opportunity to express themselves creatively through drama, music, and art, as well as providing lots of athletic experiences, swimming, horseback riding, climbing, hiking, and so on, all with a Jewish spin attached to everything. Many of these camps are also kosher, so the consciousness of eating Jewishly is also enhanced, and naturally there's a connection to Israel. In other words, it's a way for kids to have the kind of Jewish life they don't actually have at home. And the values expressed are always associated with Jewish textual and ethical ideas and traditions. Now, in describing these camps, I'm talking about sleepaway residential camps, not the day camps. Although the day camps, frankly, try to do a lot of the same things with a lower threshold of cost and supply. Now, there was a time not long ago when the future of the American Jewish world was considered to be dependent on the percentage of children we managed to send to Jewish summer camps. Because the impact of summer camps, whether they're called URJ camps or Camp Ramah or JCC camp or local names, the impact of summer camps on the formation and confirmation of Jewish identity can be pivotal. A great summer experience that includes Jewish practice and values goes a long way to build connections to Judaism that once a week religious school during the school year cannot match. No matter how high quality the 3 hours or so spent there is. And of course, our religious school at Congregation Beit Simcha is the very best, but still, living in a fully Jewish environment focused on your own age group's needs for 4 weeks in a row, night and day, well, that's got to have more impact. And then there's the fact that sometimes young men and women end up working at the camps as junior counselors and then counselors, and they meet their future Jewish mates there too, helping to advance the cause of Jewish continuity. Now, you're not seeing a lot of articles these days about the need to build more Jewish summer camps and lower the expense level so that more Jewish kids can go to camp. I wondered about this, Since just, oh, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, the whole thrust of Jewish communal efforts seemed to be directed towards pushing the further development of the summer camp movement. Perhaps, like other valuable ideas in the Jewish world, the Jewish Summer Camp for Everybody effort floundered because there are so many causes to embrace. Summer camp experiences are expensive, and there are, as always, many needs. And of course, school-age children don't vote or serve on federation or philanthropy committees or make large contributions to development campaigns, and their families are often too busy or financially strapped to do so either. But it makes you wonder. If we do not invest sufficiently in our kids, we are making a foundational error and crippling the future of the American Jewish world. Well, we have long made fun of summer camps, never more effectively than in Alan Sherman's classic Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, which we will play in just a moment. But the truth is, summer camps, Jewish summer camps, are important. And even that song ends happily with the kid engaging in energetic play and forging new friendships. The truth is, the more Jewish kids we can get to have profoundly positive Jewish experiences in a supportive and loving Jewish environment, well, the better for the future of our people. And so here he is, the late, great Alan Sherman's classic hit, now, oh boy, more than 60 years old.
Hello, Mudda. Hello, Fada. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner? He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators, and the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mudda Fada, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest Fada, darling Mudda, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball, gee, that's better. Mudda Fada, kindly disregard this letter.
That was Alan Sherman's classic, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada. So send your kids to Jewish camp, or your grandkids, and if you don't have kids or grandkids in that age range, help somebody else to do so. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, the remarkable A.J. Jacobs, truly lives his books. He was last here on To Jewish talking about his book, The Year of Living Biblically, which was both great fun and deeply insightful. Find out what led this award-winning, best-selling author to write his new book, The Year of Living Constitutionally, how that worked and why it's Jewish, when we come back in just a moment right here on To Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome back to Jewish our guest this morning. A.J. Jacobs is one of the most, I think, colorful and entertaining authors, a man of letters, but particularly a man who embodies his texts. He was here talking about his previous book, from his previous books, The Year of Living Biblically, and now he has decided to live constitutionally. Good morning and welcome back to Two Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good morrow to you.
So, nobody moves into their subject like you, I don't think, in the history of literature. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to live constitutionally.
Well, yes, you're right. I like to commit to the bit, as my son says. Well, this book was a bit of a sequel to the one we talked about before, The Year of Living Biblically, where I tried to follow everything in the Bible, from the Ten Commandments to growing a beard to not wearing clothes made of two kinds of fabric. And I loved that experience, and readers responded, so I thought...
And you didn't lose your family over it, let's be clear.
It was close. It was touch and go for a while. But yes, my wife stayed with me. And this time, I wanted to do the similar approach to the Constitution, because I do think a lot of the same issues come up. How do we interpret this document, which has incredible influence over our lives? And how much should we pay attention to the original meaning? How much should the meaning evolve? And so I decided to explore it. I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to live by the original meaning, and I'm going to carry a musket around the streets of New York City, which I did. That's my Second Amendment right. I gave up social media in favor of writing pamphlets with a quill. That is my First Amendment.
First Amendment. Yep.
Right.
Let's be clear.
I petitioned, also part of my First Amendment right. I quartered soldiers in my New York apartment, my Third Amendment, right? So it was fascinating and wild and insightful. And I couldn't have predicted that it would be quite this timely, because you see on the front pages every day another constitutional controversy.
You do indeed. Briefly, there are many parallels between the Constitution and the Torah. The Torah has sometimes been called the Jewish Constitution. We're not strict constructionist Jews. How did that parallel with your experience?
Right. That was one of the fascinating takeaways of the Bible book, is, of course, that we should not take the Bible too literally. Because it leads to such things as believing the world was created in 6 days, or that homosexuality is a sin.
Abomination, actually. Yep.
And of course, the Jewish people have the Talmud and the oral tradition to sort of mediate between the literal meaning of the word and the Jewish beliefs and actions. With the Constitution, though, there right now is a movement towards literalism and textualism. Five of the 9 Supreme Court justices, the conservative ones, subscribe to originalism, which is sort of a frozen in time. Let's look back and see what the Constitution meant. And that is interestingly, not a very Jewish way to look at the Constitution. I feel that it is the, and you can correct me, is it Peshat and Drash? Are they two words when interpreting?
No, you're quite right. Pshat and Drash, that's correct. And Pshat is the literal interpretation, just, you know, word for word, and Drash the interpretive. That's correct.
Right. So originalism is very Pshat oriented. And you can see the Jewish justices on the Supreme Court throughout history have been more interested in the Drash, such as Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Breyer and Alana Kagan. So I do think it's an interesting parallel in how we interpret the Constitution and the Torah.
We will talk much more with A.J. Jacobs about what it's like to live constitutionally when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this late spring and summer. Established more than 5 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school sign-ups are going on now for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us for our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with fabulous Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Our services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning services, 10 a.m., preceded at 9 a.m. by a wonderful Torah study, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can come to services in person or on our Facebook page. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom, including Torah study on Zoom Saturday morning. Access those by going to the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, to join, to come to our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us. TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, and of course on Apple iTunes. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields.
You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And as usual, welcome back.
Thank you.
Not back to Too Jewish, but back from Italy this time, one of your many jaunts, but a particular part of Italy, Puglia, the southern part. Tell us a little bit about it.
All right, so Puglia is one of two regions in the far south of Italy. There's Calabria, which is more like the toe of the boot, and there's Puglia, which is more like the heel. And Puglia is probably the biggest province in all of Italy. It's huge from north to south. And it has two seashores, one on the Ionian Sea and one on the Adriatic Sea. Net result of that is every time you order fish, it's fish that was swimming 3 or 4 hours ago.
Yeah,
and
fresh.
Because it's so fresh, it has no smell, and they frequently serve it raw. Or the most interesting, I mean, I always thought the Japanese were the only people who ate raw fish, but the Pugliese have several ways of preparing raw fish, and my favorite turned out to be what they call a tartare, which is you take a fish, you gut it, you use the bones to make a fish stock eventually for a soup or a stew, and the meat you grind in an old-fashioned meat grinder that like our grandmothers used to make chopped liver with scallions and Calabrian chilies and some lemon juice. And it comes out like this smooth, delicious, slightly spicy spread. And they serve it with hot focaccia right out of the oven. And you smear it on the focaccia and there's like, you're in heaven.
Sounds delicious. Also sounds like the way that you would make gefilte fish, except you don't cook it. You just serve it fresh and raw. I don't know any Jewish history in that part of Italy. I know there's a tremendous amount of Jewish history all over Italy. Tell us what you discovered.
Okay.
Besides this amazing fish spread.
Right. I discovered a lot, actually, probably too much to cover in this one session. But first I want to tell you a little small world story that happened to us. So my guide was a guy who grew up in Milano, who spent about 6 weeks with me in Tucson when his plans to go to Tulane for a year were interrupted by Hurricane Katrina, and we had to find an alternative, which turned out to be Indiana University in Bloomington.
Oh.
And it all worked out fine in the end, but what he expected to be like a five-day stay with me turned into like a five-week stay.
Wow.
And it was fine. We got to know each other very well.
I'll bet.
And then, as now, we have three languages in common that we float among when we have conversations. Serbian, English, Italian, and actually also Russian, which we both took in high school. So there's four languages we can converse in. And he has a lot of curiosity about Jewish culture and history and practice. His wife is from the Sephardic Jewish community of Istanbul, and her mother's French-speaking. They all are there. All the intelligentsia in old Istanbul spoke French, just like in Thessaloniki.
Okay.
Any well-educated person, you didn't have to be Jewish to speak French, but certainly all the Jews did. And so, well,
back to the lingua franca days, the days when French was the most important, sophisticated language.
So Sabine's mother is more French than Italian. In any case, she's Jewish, therefore her sons are Jewish, and Urosh cares about them going to Hebrew school and having a bar mitzvah. And his wife couldn't care less. Urosh is actually more capable of running a Passover Seder than his wife is.
And his Jewish wife. Yep.
And Urosh doesn't have a drop of Jewish blood. But he's got a lot of Jewish friends. Anyway, long story short, he advanced the hypothesis that Yiddish was, quote, just German written in Hebrew letters. So I, of course, being a chronic educator, said, no, that's not quite right. There's a lot of words of both Hebrew origin and Slavic origin, including one from your home country, which is schlepovat, which is like to tow or to drag, and that's the root of all the words like schlep, schlepper, schlept, etc. So at that point in the conversation, two elderly couples at the table right behind us at an outdoor cafe in Brindisi, this little town in the far south of Italy, turn to us and say, excuse me, but are you guys Jewish? And Urosh said, I'm not, but my wife is and my good friend here is. And they said, well, so are we. We grew up in Lviv speaking Yiddish. And it's amazing to meet a Yiddish-speaking person here in Brindisi. Would never have expected this. Then it turns out that they know personally the hometowns of all four of my grandparents, which are all in today's Ukraine. They weren't historically, but they are now. And it was just like such an incredible small world thing that we ended up almost all hugging each other. And we'll get to the local Jewish stuff
and
history.
The local Jewish color next time. In Puglia next time. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe locks himself out of his car on a hot summer day. He's schwitzing, ready to plotz, but he manages to find an old wire coat hanger in a nearby trash can. Goes back to his car to try to open the locked door. He slides the wire through the window, and he's fishing around, trying to unlock the door. His wife, Sadie, immediately starts criticizing him and telling him what to do. Moshe, move it to the right. Now to the left. No, higher. Moshe, lower. Finally, Sadie says, what's taking you so long, Moshe? Why have you not gotten the door open yet? Moshe, now covered with sweat, replies, Sadie, it's easy for you to say. You're sitting inside an air-conditioned car. You see, she's inside with the engine running and the air conditioning on, and he's trying to... That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its English name by the census, occupying a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. The Hebrew name for this portion and this book, Bamidbar, means literally in the wilderness. The name comes from the first important words of the book. It has a great resonance, though, and the meaning is more important than simply its lexicographical location. It also speaks of place in a different and powerful way. You see, every time we Jews seek inspiration, it seems we must head out into the desert. It was true of Abraham and Jacob. It's certainly true of Moses. And after the Exodus, it's true as well for the whole people of Israel, who wander for 40 years in the wilderness of Sinai, the Midbar Sinai, seeking God and revelation. Why must we head out into nothingness to find truth? Perhaps it's simply because our own lives are so filled with complications and complexities, which seem critical during the daily grind, but most of which turn out to be truly unimportant, even trivial. But until we leave behind the conveniences of home, until we divest ourselves of our comforts and conceits, we are unable to really understand what matters. Faith blooms freely in the desert, for in the desert there is nothing to prevent a person from seeing the world as it truly is, and coming to understand God's amazing role in it as creator and maker of covenants. You too can find God in the wilderness, and that is just as true here in our Sonoran Desert in Tucson as it was in the Sinai Desert for our ancestors. We simply need to look for God, away from the complications of our daily lives. A poet asks, "Must we enter the desert to hear your voice?" Perhaps we should all answer, "Yes." When we come back in a moment, our guest, the wonderful A.J. Jacobs, tells how living constitutionally is very Jewish indeed. Find out why when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Amid harsh international criticism after the deaths of perhaps 45 Palestinian civilians, including some children, in a fire inadvertently caused by an Israeli airstrike that killed two top Hamas Palestinian terrorist commanders, Tzachi Hanegbi, the national security advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, predicted that Israel's war with Hamas will last until the end of this calendar year. That raised the specter of further bloodshed in what would be one of Israel's longest wars. The war, continuing until December or January, would certainly increase tension with the U.S. administration, which is pressing for a ceasefire. Another 7 months of fighting are ahead to deepen the achievement and obtain what we define as the destruction of Hamas's governing and military capability, Tzachi Hanegbi said last week. Israel invaded the city of Rafah in May in what Netanyahu has described as the last major stage of the battle against Hamas. The Biden administration has been seeking a temporary ceasefire it hopes could lead to a permanent end to hostilities. It has principally blamed Hamas, as it should, for not agreeing to ceasefire terms that would include the release of hostages that the Palestinian terrorist group still holds captive, in exchange for the release of multiple numbers of Palestinian security prisoners. Hamas insists that Israel must withdraw entirely from the Strip. In other news, Senator John Fetterman, the Pennsylvania Democrat who has emerged as an unlikely champion for Israel ever since October 7th, disavowed his own alma mater, Harvard University, while receiving an award at Yeshiva University's commencement ceremony last week. Fetterman and YU leaders used the commencement to portray the flagship modern Orthodox university, Yeshiva University, as a counterpoint to college campuses across the U.S., including Harvard, that have had pro-Palestinian encampments and whose graduation ceremonies have been marked by protests or sometimes canceled. In Fetterman's remarks after receiving the Presidential Medallion, which is Yeshiva University's most prestigious award for global leadership, Fetterman echoed that comparison. He said the last time he went to a graduation ceremony was his own at Harvard 25 years ago. At the mention of Harvard, the crowd hissed, and Fetterman responded. "I have been profoundly disappointed," he said, mentioning Harvard's inability to stand up for the Jewish community after October 7th. Fetterman then removed a red stole from his shoulders from Harvard's traditional graduation robe. "I do not fundamentally believe it's right for me to wear this today," Fetterman said to great applause. Since the Israel-Hamas war began nearly 8 months ago with the atrocities perpetrated by the Palestinian terrorists, Fetterman has been one of the most outspoken supporters of Israel at the U.S. Capitol, wallpapering his office with pictures of hostages held by Hamas, wearing dog tags showing his support for their release. The approach has earned him opponents on the left, the progressive left, which used to be his strongest supporters, and uncharacteristically support from friends on the right. "I'm just a senator with a big mouth who happens to be committed to Israel," Fetterman said in his remarks at the ceremony, drawing enthusiastic applause. In addition to voicing support for Israel's war effort, Fetterman said, "I actually grieve for all the innocent Palestinian women and children that Hamas is responsible for taking." Rabbi Ari Berman, YU's president, said the decision to invite Fetterman was unanimous for the university. "Standing for Israel is a source of great strength for our community. It's our privilege to honor him, said the YU president. Everyone was very excited about it. And three eulogies to deliver today on deaths of prominent Jews last month. Jewish novelist Paul Auster, whose New York trilogy in the 80s and 90s vaulted him into the front ranks of American novelists, died in May of lung cancer. Raised in West Orange and nearby Maplewood, New Jersey, heavily Jewish suburbs of Newark, he depicted in the 2017 autobiographical novel 4321. Paul Auster looked east to New York, became one of its most iconic chroniclers. In the trilogy City of Glass, Ghosts, and The Locked Room, he used the conventions of detective novels and film noir to explore what one interviewer called the annihilation of identity in the urban world. And like Philip Roth, another Jewish-American writer from Newark, Auster used the metafictional trope of including himself, or at least an avatar named Paul Auster, as a character in his novels. Hugely prolific, Auster wrote more than 30 books, Timbuktu, Moon Palace, The Music of Chance, and most recently Bumgardner. Not all were critically acclaimed, but even when reviews were mixed, he could count on adoration in Europe. He was one of the most popular American literary exports. Paul Auster was also a filmmaker. He collaborated with co-director Wayne Wang on the cult movie Smoke, starring Harvey Keitel and William Hurt. Good film about a Brooklyn tobacco shop and its eccentric clientele, and the sequel, Blue in the Face. Auster was born in 1947 to Jewish parents in Newark. His father, Sam, good name, owned a furniture shop and sold real estate. According to family lore, as a teenager, was fired from a job at Thomas Edison's laboratory because he was Jewish. Auster himself studied at Columbia starting in 1965, took part in some of the anti-Vietnam War protests. In his autobiography, Hand to Mouth, Auster recounts how he abandoned a postgraduate degree, took a job on an oil tanker, and scraped by as a poet in Paris. Paul Auster said it was during this period he became interested in Jewish history and Jewish questions. He noted the influence of three great Jewish writers, the great poet and Holocaust survivor Paul Celan, the Egyptian-born Edmund Jabez, and the New Yorker Charles Reznikoff. It got me thinking about my own relationship to Judaism and the relationship of Judaism to writing, Auster said. In an essay about Reznikoff, Auster mused on the double consciousness of being Jewish and American, describing it as the condition of being in two places at the same time, or quite simply, the condition of being nowhere.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
Ivan Boesky, a financier whose role in an illegal insider trading scheme in the go-go 1980s sent shockwaves through a Jewish community to which he had been a very generous donor, died last week. He was 87. Prior to his indictment in 1987 on a federal charge of conspiring to make false, fictitious, and fraudulent statements to the federal government, Boesky was a high-profile member of the Jewish philanthropic community in New York, a member of the board of the Jewish Theological Seminary, and president of the JTS Library Corporation. The head of an arbitrage business that wagered on companies Boesky thought might be takeover targets, Boesky pled guilty that year, 87, to a single conspiracy charge after agreeing to cooperate with the federal investigation of illegal insider trading and to wear a wire in conversations with senior investment figures. Boesky's role in the illegal insider trading was revealed in November 86. Boesky's fall shocked the Jewish community then. Stories of his and other financiers' excesses, he famously arrived in a helicopter at a bar mitzvah reception held on the QE2, rented for the occasion by a real estate developer. While that fed stereotypes of Jewish avarice, leading commentators and rabbis to emphasize that the arbitragers represented only themselves. At the same time, Boesky's misdeeds and that of one of his closest allies, the junk bond financier Michael Milken, who also ended up in prison, in part through Boesky's cooperation, wearing a wire for the feds, forced a reckoning within the Jewish community to which Boesky had given millions. It led to an anguished debate among institutions over accepting money from philanthropists of questionable character or who were in legal jeopardy. Boesky's reputation was burnished, or perhaps tarnished, depending on your point of view, when he inspired the character of an avaricious corporate raider, Gordon Gekko, in Oliver Stone's 1987 film Wall Street. Gekko's tagline, "Greed is Good," was inspired by a 1986 speech Boesky gave to business school students in which he said, "Greed is all right, by the way. I think greed is healthy. You can be greedy and still feel good about yourself." The students cheered. And while Oliver Stone intended Wall Street as a cautionary tale, the line was said by the Jewish actor Michael Douglas, Gecko became something of a folk hero. Personal note, when Boesky was an inmate at a kind of club fed, a low-security facility in Lompoc, California, back in the 1980s, they brought him to Passover services at the temple in Santa Barbara, where I was the cantor and led the morning services. Boesky was polite and kind of participatory. Although he had paid hundreds of millions of dollars in fines by then, he did not donate anything to our synagogue that Pesach, or ever, to my knowledge. We never had to worry about the ethical challenge. Finally, Yael Dayan, daughter of the famed Israeli military and political leader Moshe Dayan, who charted her own course as a champion of peace, gay rights, and women's rights in Israel, died last week at the age of 85. A journalist who wrote novels and memoirs, Dayan also served in the Israeli Knesset for three terms between 1993 and 2002, representing the Labor Party and a centrist coalition, the One Israel Party. She later served as chair of the Tel Aviv City Council representing Meretz. Yael Dayan was daughter of Israel's founding Ashkenazi royalty. Her father was, of course, Moshe Dayan, architect of Israel's victories in 67 and, I guess, 73, and her grandfather, Shmuel Dayan, who served in Israel's first government. May they all rest in peace. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish, the most entertaining A.J. Jacobs, who truly lives his books. His new book is called The Year of Living Constitutionally. You may have and should have read his book, The Year of Living Biblically, which was a ton of fun. So is this one. So, first of all, I have to ask kind of the generic question. What was the biggest surprise about the experience of living constitutionally?
Well, I would say just how different the past is. You know, you've heard historians say the past is a different country. I mean, it is a different world. So even just the way that carrying a musket, that was wild because it is such a different machine from modern guns. I shot it. I went out. I got the musket on the old internet. So I...
There's a certain anachronistic quality to that. I'm sorry, you didn't go hunting old gun shops and antiquarians. You got your musket on the internet.
I did. It was a little fudging, but I did carry it around New York, and I also went and shot it. And shooting a musket is not easy. It takes 15, literally 15 steps. You have
right.
to take out the gunpowder, pour the gunpowder in. And take out the ramrod, put the ramrod back.
Put the ball in, push it down. You probably didn't put a ball in, actually, if you were... Well, maybe. I don't know. Did you shoot anything with it?
Yeah. No, I shot posters of redcoats with it. So I committed. And it is, it's like building an IKEA desk. It's not easy. So that the question is, when we have such different guns now that fire so quickly... should different rules apply? So that was one of the themes. So that was a big surprise. Another big surprise was all of the parts of the Constitution that never get any publicity. We all know about the First and Second Amendment, but what about the letters of mark and reprisal? That was in there. I never heard of it. So I Googled it, and it turned out it is basically the Constitution gives private citizens the right to become pirates, legalized pirates, government-sanctioned pirates, or privateers, because this was how we won the revolution.
Well, because the British Navy was the most powerful navy in the world, and America didn't have anything like a navy, so they authorized privateers to attack British ships in the revolutionary period. Now, a lot of those privateers...
Isaac Mowat.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you're allowed to be an outlaw, provided you're doing it on behalf of the National Service somehow.
Exactly. It is a patriotic outlaw. And so I actually did apply to be the first privateer in since 1815, and I met with Congress, and it's still in negotiations, so keep your fingers crossed. Sir.
I will. Who would you attack?
Well, that's a great question. That's a great question. Anyone who we happen to be in a conflict with. So my friend has a water skiing boat, so the idea is just to put some cannons on that and go out maybe to the Taiwan Strait. I mean, my wife is very relieved I never did get the privateer license. If I did, then maybe I would have to go out on the high seas.
So, by the way, carrying a musket around New York City doesn't impress me as anything anybody would even look at twice. I mean,
I don't know. Even in New York, that was still, because I will say, I got people who, both positive and negative. So some people cross the street to avoid me. One time, though, I walked into a coffee shop with my musket, and I arrived at the same time as this other customer, and he said, you go first. I'm not going to argue with the guy. So it did come in handy.
Yeah, yeah, valuable. There were Jews, of course, in America going back to the 17th century. First synagogue founded in New York was founded by refugees from Recife in Brazil. You as a constitutional liver, that sounds like an organ, not a person, but as a constitutional observer, let's say, what did you do Jewishly? Where did you go and what did you explore?
Well, one of my favorite adventures was spending time with the Sherith Israel, which is a congregation here in New York City. It's currently on the Upper West Side, but it used to be downtown. And I think it's the oldest congregation in America, not the oldest building, because there are other in Rhode Island, they still have
the Touro Synagogue and so on, right?
Right. But this one has been around since the 1600s, and it was fascinating to read about how the revolution and the Constitution affected this congregation. One way was they wrote a constitution. They had a constitution for their shul, and they weren't the only ones. Apparently, a lot of congregations wrote constitution, the Jewish congregation, after the constitution. Another interesting fact was that they used to, before the Revolutionary War, they used to say a prayer for the king, and everyone would stand when the prayer for King George was said. After the Revolution and the constitution, they said a prayer for the president. But the big difference was they made certain that no one was standing for the president. And if you would be standing for the prayer right before, then you would sit down for this prayer for the president and stand up again. And it was very important because it was meant to underscore this president is not sacred. He is not a deity. He is worthy of our respect and our prayers, but we should not be standing up for him. And so I love that. And I went to a morning, they still do it. They still do this morning prayer.
Yeah, every
Saturdays,
day.
And I went and participated.
What's the most valuable lesson you took out of this constitutional experiment?
Well, great question. I have in the book at the end 10 takeaways, the bill of takeaways. So I have 10. And I would say it's hard to choose which one is my favorite, but maybe I'll choose this one because it has a Jewish flavor to it. And that is to be open and flexible in our thinking, because I love the part of Judaism about wrestling with text and questioning and not just accepting things on faith, but thinking about them and weighing the pros and cons, everything has two sides. And I love that our founding fathers were much more open to this. And just one example is Ben Franklin. At the convention, he said, the older I get, the less certain I am of my own opinion. And he told this story of a French lady who said to her sister, it's so strange that I'm the only person I've ever met who is correct on every single issue. And his point was, we all are that French lady. We all think we're correct on every single issue, and we're not. So we have to look at the evidence, and if it contradicts our preconceived notions, to be able to evolve. And I love that as a lesson. I think we really need it in America right now, where we're super intransigent and refuse to budge in our beliefs. So let's get back to that, what I think is a more Jewish and more patriotic frame of mind.
What a beautiful perspective. I want to thank A.J. Jacobs for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called The Year of Living Constitutionally. He's written a lot of other books. Where can people go to find out more about you, which doesn't require that they take up quill and parchment?
Yes, feel free to write me a quill letter. But if not, then I'm on the less, the more 21st century media of the internet, ajjacobs.com. I have a Substack at Experimental Living with AJ Jacobs. And yeah, I would love to hear from folks. And if they do want a quill signed nameplate, if they buy the book and want me to sign their name in quill, I will happily do that and send it to them via snail mail. So just email me about that.
Yeah, you can't email them that. That's too special. AJ, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's always a joy.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Dr. Sarah Glass, therapist and author of the new book, Kissing Girls on Shabbat. Please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night, services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from Noah and Mira Awad. It's a song that has added meaning right now. This was Israel's entry in the Eurovision contest way back in 2009, and it's called There Must Be Another Way, sung in Hebrew, Arabic, and English. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of justice and peace.
There must be another, must be another way. Kol ma shelibi mevakesh omrot.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.